This is a personal story. If you listened to episode 27 of this show, you heard me talk about my struggle with the idea of God. How, despite wanting the comfort of a higher power, I struggle to deny the logic and empiricism that make belief so difficult. But as I said in closing, I intended to continue that struggle, and indeed I have. I have tried to open myself up to the presence of something greater, tried not to chalk up every moment of potential cosmic alignment to mere coincidence, but to instead allow myself to consider that perhaps something more may be afoot. Something else you've heard me talk about, if you've been following along, is how I've never celebrated the holiday of Shavuot. In fact, I didn't really know what it was, beyond involving the harvest and dairy delights. My guest Sarah Hurwitz said it was her favorite holiday, and I thought, that's interesting, I should look into that. I delivered a monologue about going full Jew, and have been looking for ways to continue that in my own life, like maybe finally learning what Shavuot is all about. I asked Tessa Vexler and Eden Yadigar what their favorite holiday is, and they said Shavuot. I said, that's it, I'm doing it. So when prepping for my episode with Chris Cairns-Nunn, I finally did the research, and at last came to understand how it's not just an important holiday, but is, in many ways, the important holiday. It's the anniversary of the moment when God made his covenant with the Israelites at Mount Sinai, offering them the laws, stories, and customs that would transform a ragtag group of escaped slaves into a nation. It's the moment when the Jewish people became the Jewish people. How the hell was I sleeping on that? Numerous email newsletters I subscribed to in the past year mentioned Shavuot, including one that quoted the Zohar, the primary Kabbalistic text, saying, "The voice of Hashem continues to resonate from Sinai, reaching each soul according to its capacity." Meaning, each person continues to receive the voice of God in their own way, a personalized living revelation. I don't know, could be coincidence, but does kind of sound like exactly what I'm looking to hear, right? On Dan Senor's podcast, Rachel Goldberg-Polin waxed philosophic about Shavuot, reminding me that this is when we read the Book of Ruth, the story of the first convert, the first Jew by choice, a woman so full of honor and strength, she would go on to become the matriarch of the family that would birth the great King David only three generations later. Which, of course, spoke to me, as my own wife, weekly shout out to Courtney, made the same astonishingly brave choice, for which I am forever grateful. And you should be too, for as I like to say, Courtney's the best thing to happen to the Jewish people since the Ten Commandments. And her regal presence is already bearing fruit for our Jewish community at home, in which she is an admired leader, and in our three children, who are each a credit to their amazing mother. Three children. Still getting used to saying that. Because after months of walking an invisible road that seemed to lay itself out beneath my feet, my youngest daughter, Gianna Liora, was born just a few days ago on Shavuot. I didn't get the chance to stay up all night studying Torah because I was busy studying my daughter's face, which in a way is the same thing, a living continuation of that covenant made at Sinai, a promise fulfilled, another star in the brilliant Jewish sky. Ask me what my favorite holiday is now. Then there's Gianna's Hebrew name, which I'd already decided weeks before her birth. Typically, I'd save it as a surprise for her naming ceremony, but Courtney already told everyone on planet Earth her English name months ago, so I figured what the hell. Even before being born on the birthday of the Jewish people, her name was to be Yisraela Chaya. Israel lives. How's that for cosmic alignment? And as I looked at my daughter, processing the deep meaning of her name and her very existence, another thought popped into my head, one I've had over and over again in the months since launching this podcast. I've had the privilege to visit and speak to a dozen Jewish communities across the world this year, and without fail, I have observed that in each and every place, the soul, the engine, the doers and makers and shapers and builders of every one of these communities are Jewish women. The CEOs, the presidents, the rabbis, a lot of these are Jewish men, and they're amazing, and I'm sure there's a whole discussion we can have about that. But the people creating the programming, raising the money, planning the events, writing the curriculums, heading the schools, running the charities, leading the campus groups, teaching our children, charting the course that keeps the Jewish people alive are women. And there's usually one gay Gen Zer doing social media and a millennial doing tech stuff. Shout out to those guys. The Jewish communal world is run by women. I've seen it in LA, in Cleveland, in Toronto, in Atlanta, in New York City. I saw it in Venice, Italy, home of the world's first Jewish ghetto, where today's Venice Chabad and only kosher restaurant exist, both of which are run by the Rebbetzin, who on the strength of her energy and commitment has built a dynamic and radiant community within the very bricks once meant to suppress our luminosity. My own family is overflowing with amazing Jewish women, from my sisters to my aunts to my cousins, educators, lay leaders, board members, temple presidents. And then, of course, there's my mom, who we all know is the GOAT, but we'll get into that more in a couple episodes. Even this podcast. Outside the production company I partner with, every single individual hire on the core team is a Jewish woman. Eight of them, if you include my publicist and fiscal sponsor, too. No wonder, then, that I am in awe of and indebted to Jewish women. Smart, capable professionals who could work in any number of fields, but instead, for whatever reason, have put the rest of us on their backs and devoted themselves to the betterment and continuation of our people, beyond just its religious life, and are keeping the Jewish community alive. So, back to my daughter. In true Talmudic fashion, let's look at her name again. Yisrael Achaya, Israel lives, but female. The lifeblood of the Jewish people is women, and now I'm blessed to be father to two of them. And so as I reflect on my own journey to Shavuot, to my own personal living revelation, I wonder if maybe the path I've been led to walk down isn't in fact about me at all. Maybe it's about marrying my Ruth, bringing her kick-ass genes into the bloodline, and raising the Jewish daughters who will bring future glory to our people. Maybe I believe in God, maybe I don't. But I know I believe in Jewish women, and I'll do my very best to raise two of them to be the kind of leaders who make our people proud. That is, to hopefully be just like all of you. This is the 37th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Today is an honest-to-God trailblazer. Not a Portland trailblazer, he's actually an Auburn Tiger, but a man who has carved a path through a profession where Jewish leaders are rare and a proud, outspoken ones non-existent before he came along. He's been a winner at every level, turning around one college basketball program after another, leaving a legacy of excellence and a little controversy in his wake. He's coached at four universities, has four kids, and just took his squad to their second Final Four. Please welcome the coach with Kavanah, Bruce Pearl.
It's great to be here.
Oh, man. So you just finished a big, successful season. Any days off since then? Have you had a second to catch your breath?
I took a day off at Passover.
One day, okay.
I've taken 3 days off. But listen, I've got a roster to rebuild. And as soon as I get that roster rebuilt, we'll take a few days off.
3 days. Good for you, coach. Unmitigated success, as I said. You know, you guys were number one for a big chunk of the season. You won the SEC regular season, Maui Invitational, second Final Four ever. How are you feeling?
Well, you know, it's funny. During the season, you get asked a lot of times to reflect on how you're doing, and then you don't really want to do it because you're still in the middle of it, so
sure.
It's not over. It's not a time to reflect. And then as soon as it gets over, guys are going. I got five or six guys that are trying to get in the NBA and professional teams to talk to and agents and everything there. And I got to replace my whole roster. The time will come at some point, maybe at some point this summer, when my wife and I are out on the boat and the sun is going down and maybe we'll have some music on and we'll thank God for the blessings and we'll enjoy it. But, you know, you look back at kids that have graduated or great teams and championship teams, and it'll mean a lot to me years from now, as much as it means, you know, right now.
Beautiful. One of the most notable accomplishments of this season, at least for the Jewish community, was the way that you were so outspoken about the situation with the hostages, especially Edon Alexander, who miraculously, thank God, is now home. What was that moment like for you seeing that happen finally, which you've been pushing for and praying for?
I'd like to tell you the whole story because
please.
You know, I'm obviously an advocate for Israel, and we'll talk about that mm-hmm. a lot. The game is over at Rupp Arena. We've just beaten Creighton, a team that had been to four out of the last five Sweet 16s. We go into that game. We're not playing great, and we really got a chance to get beat, and we play great, and we win the game, and there's a real chance to go to the Final Four, so I'm happy. And I'm walking through the halls of Rupp Arena getting ready to go to the press conference, and I'm just thanking God, and I'm just like, God, really? Man, I mean, thank you. I mean, I'm calling God, like I got my shirt on. And I don't know, he spoke to me and he said, look, remember who you are. Remember where you're from. Remember what your Hebrew name is, Mordechai. And of course, you know the story of Purim and Queen mm-hmm. Esther. Uncle Mordechai had to speak into the queen so that she would speak to the king, that so Haman wouldn't get his wish and have the very first Holocaust, or one of the first Holocausts of the Jews.
Yeah.
And fortunately, she did. And so I've always been willing to speak up, and my papa taught me that's why he named me Mordechai.
Wow.
So I said to the guys, I'm walking with Janai Broome and Denver Jones and Tahad Pettifer. I said, guys, listen, you guys know what an advocate I am for Israel. I got to tell you what just happened. The name Edan Alexander just came into my heart, came into my mind. I said to my sports information director, I said, do me a favor. I want to make sure I got this right. I think he's the only American held hostage. In other words, I wasn't even sure that that was correct. But I said, and she's like, coach, we're going to a press conference to talk about the Sweet 16. I said, look up the only American still held hostage. Find it. Google it. Boom. Edan Alexander. I said, all right, that's a sign. I'm doing it. I said, guys, I don't want to take anything away from our moment, your moment. But this is what just happened. We got American held hostage. I want to start a press conference with it. They're like, coach, absolutely 100%.
To give me an opportunity to just start this press conference really briefly and remind the world that Edan Alexander is still held hostage in Gaza right now.
And then Tahad says, coach, that kid's from Jersey. Well, Tahad's from Jersey City, New Jersey, so he even knew where the young man was from.
That's amazing.
And sure enough, we did it. And of course, you know, it got a lot of attention. It meant a lot to Edan's family. I heard from his father. I heard from his family. The next weekend, they joined us in Atlanta for the Sweet 16. I asked his father if he would speak to our team, and he did the day of the Michigan game.
Can you tell me about that guest. For a moment? Can you tell me what he said?
My son was your age. Mm. My son was 18 years old. He just graduated from high school, and he said to me, Dad, you know what I want to do? Before I get started on the rest of my life, I just want to go to Israel, and I want to join the IDF and serve Israel for a little while before I get started on everything else. And so it sort of hit home with my guys going, look, my son made a choice before he had a chance to go play basketball at Auburn, for example, to go do this.
Right.
And this is what happened to him. And this is what we're praying for. And it was very, very sweet. And our guys obviously were heartfelt for what this father and Edan's brother, Roy, were going through. And it just made us all be grateful for the position that we're in. I heard from people in Israel. I heard from the president of Israel. I heard from Prime Minister Netanyahu. Their heart breaks when they see Americans, particularly Americans. They're used to Canada. They're used to Great Britain. They're used to France already. They ain't worried about that, because they're used to it by now. But when the United States of America and college students and different people celebrate Hamas and the atrocities, it just breaks their heart. And I make sure they understand, Mr. Prime Minister, Mr. President, they are the loud minority. Hmm. America has your back.
Now, jumping ahead to Edan's release, like, where were you in that moment? Did you connect with them at all? What did that feel like?
We were really worried that after the Final Four, when there seemed like it was going to be any day now, it got quiet again.
Yeah.
For about 3 or 4 weeks, right? And there was some word out there that he may not still be alive. And I did know that there was a lot of talk before President Trump was traveling to the Middle East, that they were working on trying to do something big prior to his trip, or maybe right after his trip, sort of as a reward for the president traveling there and at least having dialogue with some of the people in Saudi or United Arab Emirates mm-hmm. or Qatar. And, sure enough, it happened. We will take one family, and one victory at a time. We'll take it.
When you spoke out, it is so commendable, and I'm sure you've heard it a lot, but it really is, because that was a time, first of all, it was a time where the world had gotten very quiet about the hostages in general, and yeah. You arguably had the largest platform of any Jew sort of speaking about them in any professional level. You had the Sweet 16 cameras pointed at you when the whole nation, people who are not thinking about this at all, are watching, and you took that opportunity. And I'm curious, the conversation you had with your players, you sort of like, yeah, of course they were cool that we brought, and you moved through it, which is amazing. I just want to dig into that a little bit.
I had no idea how much that aspect of this story spoke to people. That, first of all, that I would ask the players their permission before I would talk about it. But then the response that the players had for me, knowing, how much I love this country, and knowing that it bothers me that American is held hostage while we're celebrating. And what it reminds me of, and I hadn't thought about this. that's very Jewish, by the way. When we have a wedding,
yeah,
we're celebrating, we're happy, we are dancing, we're singing, we're putting our parents up on chairs. And yet when we get married, one of the traditions is to break the glass.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about? Well, it's to remind us that even in our happiest moments, the Second Temple was destroyed in Jerusalem.
Yep.
That is so Jewish that in the midst of a celebration that you would think of something, to either tragic or sad. And that's what was for me. Mm. I think that's why God spoke to me, because he's like, all right, I know you're happy, and I know you're dancing, and I know you're singing, and I know you're like going down the yellow brick road like Dorothy would be right now, but Idan is in a cave. He is in a tunnel. He doesn't know when his next meal is going to be, or when he's going to be beaten next, or whether or not he's ever going to see his family. Why does that happen? How does that come to you? And it came to me. And the only reason why now I look back at it, why it was, I guess, meaningful, and I don't like getting thanked for it, because these are the things that we're supposed to do, but
totally.
I did speak to an audience following college basketball that may not even known we had an American held hostage in Gaza. And that's the thing about it is, we assume, because you and I maybe follow the news and this is something that we're interested in, and you've got your podcast and you've got your voice, and thank God for you and your voice and your messaging. But many people are just busy in life and doing other things.
I'd say probably the majority.
To me, that might may have had some significance.
What was the reaction from all of that, from the people around you, not your players, but, the other colleagues, the other teams, people like that who are in your circle?
The reaction that I would care most about was certainly the reaction that I got from American Jewry, or for the folks in Israel, or patriots in this, that love our country. And very importantly, the people here at Auburn, in the sense that this was their moment also. And I just don't think I took away from their moment. I think I added to their moment. I think they were happy and proud and willing to share Auburn's great moment with, with something that mattered, something of the kingdom, something bigger than just basketball. So the reason why I get upset about that is I'm grateful for that. I'm just so grateful that's how the vast majority of our Auburn's fans felt. And so, when Idan was released, it made more of a celebration, even for the Auburn family.
That's beautiful. I'm so glad you felt you had that support.
I did.
You were coaching in the Final Four along with two other Jewish coaches, Todd Golden and John Shire, which is an amazing milestone to have three of the four coaches in this major tournament at this stage be Jews. I mean, what does that say about where Jews are in America today?
You have three Jewish basketball coaches get to the Final Four. Don't tell me this isn't the greatest country in the world. Don't tell me this is not an opportunity for everybody. There are going to be obstacles for every one of us. There were obstacles for you. There are going to be obstacles for my young players to have success or happiness or whatever it may be, but they're not roadblocks. There are not roadblocks. And so I've got a group of African-American young men that sometimes may have been taught or believe, well, I can't do it because my forefathers, and they couldn't do it. Say, you know what? No, these are obstacles, not roadblocks. If three Jewish basketball coaches can get to the Final Four, and whether it's not easy because there aren't that many of us, or you know, the different challenges that we're faced with anti-Semitism or things along those lines, it obviously can happen. It also talks a little bit about the Jewish history in the game of basketball, in the sense that, you know, some of the best early NBA players, you know, were Jewish because the game was played best in the ghettos, and that's where we lived. Mm. We didn't play baseball very early on because, you know, we didn't live out in the parks and the fields. We grew up in a city. You get a ball and you put a basket on a pole and you start playing. So the Jewish people have always had a little bit more of a close connection to basketball than some of the other major sports. Now, Hank Greenberg and Sandy Koufax might take issue with that.
Right. But well, I love hearing that because I have always known and felt the deep connection between Jews and hoops. It's like a thing. But it's so interesting to hear it placed in history in that way, and that it's sort of in the DNA for us. And I had never heard it framed that way. So I love that.
I'm very proud of being Jewish.
So let's go into that, family and Jewish and identity. Your grandfather came to America in the 20s, before the Holocaust, fleeing from the pogroms. But I've also heard you talk about how much of a mark the Holocaust left on your family, even though they were already in America. Can you tell me about that?
Papa came here when he was 11 years old in 1929. And he left Ternopil, which was sort of Ukraine, Russia, Austria back in the day. Mm-hmm. He wanted me to know that this country saved our family's life by being able to emigrate here. And then when Papa turned 32, 22 years after he came to America, he became a United States citizen. And he told me that was the happiest day in his life. And so he taught me to love our country, to be grateful for our country, but also to cherish our ancestral Jewish homeland. And, you know, I'll never forget, you know, Papa loving Israel, and part of his love for Israel was that he was always sad that Israel wasn't born till 1948, because he thought like maybe if in 1929 it was there, more of his family could have afforded to flee the pogroms and eventually the Holocaust. Sure. And he'd have more aunts and uncles and cousins now.
Clearly your grandfather had such an enormous impact on you and the man that you've become. What kind of impact are you trying to have on your grandkids?
Wow, that's a great question. That's something I've actually been thinking about lately. My grandfather worked really hard. He was a plumber, and he worked 6 days a week. He kept Sabbath. He kept Shabbat. And he was also went to temple the mornings and wrapped tefillin almost every morning.
Wow.
And he worked every Sunday, but he made time for me. He made time for me to so I could get to know him and love him. And it was always something that I dreamed of doing, was getting to be 13, because I couldn't go to temple with him in the mornings. I wasn't old enough, or at least the Orthodox temple that he went to. And I had to be bar mitzvahed in order to be able to do that. And I got about 6 months of Papa and tefillin before he died. He died very young. He was 63. I was 13.
That's very young.
You talk about my being Jewish. I think it's wonderful that that people come in all different shapes and sizes, and there are Jews that are observant, there are Jews that aren't observant, there are Jews that are conservative and Orthodox and Reform. But at the same time, I think, because I identify so much with my faith, I think that foundation of religious school, of being bar mitzvahed, of knowing that my grandparents kept kosher and I had a role model, it really helped give me a foundation. It got me started at a younger age. And I do worry, and I'm not passing judgment. I'm not. But I think, like, for example, American Jewry, I think we need to wake up. We got to wake up, because you can say to yourself, well, I don't really practice. And, you know, I don't, you know, I just, you know, I don't always wear my star out or my chai, you know, but as a grandfather and as a father, I think it's important. My four children have all been bar mitzvahed. Mm-hmm. My four children have got great, great pride in their faith. Some practice better than others. And I'd like them all to be able to have a strong foundation for their children and to identify with their children. I've got two children that are married to Christians, and I honestly have no problem how they raise their children. That may be a little bit of a shock to some people, but I want them to have faith one way or the other. I want them to be raised Jewish, or I want them to be raised Christian. I want them to go to church. I want them to go to temple. But I also want them to know who their Jewish father or mother is. And I think we can still remain and keep the faith. And that's a kind of a, that's probably more information that you wanted to know or that you wanted to ask.
But we want it all, Bruce.
I feel strongly that faith and family has got to be a part of it. And so I said, look, if you don't want to take them to temple, you better start taking them to church. You got to get them connected to God because it's the same God. And I'm grateful that all my children have absolutely 100% maintained their Jewish identity.
That's great. What is it more for you? Because up until now, the strong piece of the Jewish connection seemed to have been more of the, like, the family, the peoplehood, the lineage. And now you're talking about how important the sort of religious faith, God, theological side of it is. Are they both equally weighted for you? Has it changed over your lifetime?
Again, I just go back to, I was so lucky. I mean, I remember Passover, and I remember, you know, incredible seders where we had tables and chairs downstairs in the basement, and dozens of people and relatives and cousins, and the door staying open for Elijah to come. The mishigas with keeping kosher, and the dishes, these dishes for this and that for that, and covering the bread and doing all the, and all these different traditions. But it was all based on family. All that practice was done with family. And that's what makes one of the things about us being Jewish, I think, so very, very, very special.
Yep.
God chose Abraham. Like, by the way, Abraham is my favorite Jew.
Why?
Because he had faith. He had faith. And while I'd like to kill my son sometimes, he was willing to sacrifice Isaac because God told him to. And that kind of faith to, you know, to pick up and leave his home and go to where God told him he was going to go. He loved Ishmael and Isaac. Now, I wasn't thrilled with what he did with Ishmael because it kind of set us up to fail. But I remember reading the fact that he loved him, and he said he would make a great, they would make a great nation of him also. And so as a coach, what I'm always trying to do is bring people together and find things that we have in common. I'm not naive at all. And I understand that they're a part of Ishmael's family that want to kill me for being Jewish. I get it. They say it. They chant it. From the river to the sea, and they've done it. Some of Ishmael's family recognized that Isaac was his brother, yeah, and that Abraham was their father. And to me, I said, guess what? We're mishpucha. Whether you like it or not, we are. And so can't we choose to recognize that our father loved both of us and promised to make a great nation of both of us and go from there?
You're speaking my language, coach. And speaking of sort of bringing different cultures together, you grew up in Massachusetts, and now you have become basically exclusively a coach in the American South. Were there a lot of Jews in Sharon where you grew up?
There were. There actually were. By the way, there's more anti-Semitism where there are more Jews. Not many Jews. There's not much anti-Semitism. You know, at our universities and colleges, we got no anti-Semitism here in Auburn. We got a wonderful small Jewish community, but there aren't enough of us and we don't make enough noise where nobody really worries about us. But you go to bigger schools where there's larger Jewish populations, that's where we're targeted. And that's where there's tremendous amount of anti-Semitism. And so, no, I love and I thank God every day for our evangelical Christian friends.
Sure.
And again, this is something that always bothered me about religion. It sort of has set us up all to fail. While I was never comfortable with the chosen people aspect of things, I wasn't thrilled that Jesus was telling his disciples, look, the only way to get there is through me.
Right.
And that kind of made it difficult for me and you and many of our other Jewish brothers and sisters. And so someday, hopefully when I get there to heaven, I can ask him why he set that up. But again, keep in mind, I'm a coach and my job is to bring people together. I didn't go to Hebrew school and learn that Jesus was born Jewish. I didn't go to Hebrew school and learn that he was a rabbi and a pretty good one. He lived his whole life in Israel, right? Well, guess what? My Christian friends, many of them, well, certainly in Boston, in the East, where Catholicism was much, much more prevalent than Christianity, they weren't going to church or 5 o'clock mass, learning about much about Jesus and Israel and the Jewish people. But you are in the evangelical South? Okay, you are, because they're reading from the Old Testament. That connects us. And our Christian family and friends are standing with Israel because they're commanded to, and I am grateful for them.
In what ways have you and this community, like, culturally exchanged with one another in your years in Auburn? I imagine there's some fun ways that has manifested.
You know, but one fun way to do this, I say to my Christian friends, I said, what time's your Passover Seder? And they're like, what? Well, what time's your Seder? Our first night of Passover is tomorrow night. Well, we're not having a Seder. I'm like, well, why not? Jesus had a Seder every year of his life. And I thought you told me you were trying to be more like Jesus, right? Oh, the Jew is supposed to have the Seder, which is what Jesus celebrated every year of his life. Oh, I get it. Okay. But I'm not trying to be more like Jesus. I thought you were. And I have fun with it that way. Uh-huh. And you know, the other thing that we do is we will have a Passover Seder, but we'll also connect the Passover Seder with the Last Supper, because that's what it was.
Right.
And so we will invite Christians over to our Seder and we'll connect the two for them. Or we'll celebrate Sukkot and that festival, a festival that Jesus celebrated every year of his life. And we'll connect the two for our Christian faith without dummying down what we're doing, but we want them to be a part of it.
Are you, for a lot of the people around there, the first Jew that they're meeting?
No, I'm not the first Jew that they're meeting, but here's the deal. Since I've had so much success coaching basketball at Auburn, do you know who Alabama's two favorite Jews are?
You.
And Jesus.
Hey, you're in rarefied air.
I'm in really good company. No, not really. Here's the deal. Because of the cotton industry, in part because of the cotton industry, there were a lot of Jews that were involved in clothing. The people that were here in the state of Alabama got some exposure to the Jewish people, maybe long before many others did. Do you know in 1943, by a unanimous vote, the Alabama State Legislature, Republicans and Democrats, unanimously voted in 1943 that the Jewish, and proclaimed and had a proclamation that the Jewish people should have a nation of their own in the land of Israel.
Alabama for the win.
Alabama for the win.
Let's talk a little bit about you as a coach. I was so interested to learn that you didn't play high school or college ball yourself. How did you learn the game and how did you learn to love the game?
I'm 15 years old. I'm the best athlete in town. I'm the first kid picked. I'm batting fourth. I'm pitching. I'm taking most of the shots. And I was an asshole. I was not a nice kid. And guess what? God said, we ain't having this. This ain't going down. I got almost a career knee injury in a football game and never, ever, ever regained the ability to be able to compete again.
Wow.
And I got to tell you, it was painful.
I'm sure.
Kids were cruel. Kids were mean. Some of my best friends were just glad to see me cut back down to size. We're a resilient people.
The most.
And so you know what I did? I became the class president. I got involved in a school musical. And I learned that those kids that I made fun of, man, they were awesome. They were smart. They were funny. Band kids are the best, man. They're the best. And it made me a better person. God did that for a reason.
Yeah.
Absolutely did that for a reason. Now, I never lost my passion for the game, my love for the game, or my feel for the game. I obviously had that, and it was God's plan, obviously, for me to be in coaching. I didn't know it at the time.
Wow. It takes a certain kind of leader and mentor to be successful, specifically at the college level, because it's not just about basketball smarts. It's about how are you organizing these young men and mentoring them and leading them. What do you think it is that makes you so successful in that way? Like, what are you doing that other coaches aren't doing?
Look, my management style is not to know it all. It's not my job to make every right decision. Now, listen, I can help us win games. We run better offense. I have better sets. We do a good job defensively. It's not my job to make every right decision, but it's the player's job to make my decisions work. And so whether it be through leadership, putting people in positions to be successful, and raising the bar, like no man rises to low expectations. So my job is to raise the level of the expectations that my players have for themselves, to get them to focus on the positives. I want to build confidence. There's no better way of building confidence than preparing. The more you prepare, the more confident you'll be.
I say that all the time in the performing arts world when people ask, you know, aren't you nervous before you go on stage? And I go, well, if I've done all the work, why would I be nervous?
Correct. If you've studied for an exam, if you've listened in class, if you've asked questions when you didn't understand, you're going to go in that game confident. I want to go to Kentucky, and I want at Rupp Arena to Kentucky look down the other and go, what in the world is Auburn so confident about? We're confident because we're prepared.
Yeah.
Now, I really think being Jewish has helped me in coaching as a teacher. Because, I mean, I think, look, rabbis teach. That's what they do. And we work hard. We work hard to get educated. We work hard to save. We work hard to teach our children. We work hard to have these values. And these are some of the reasons why the Jewish people should be proud and have been, you know, Nobel Prize Peace winners or accomplished so many different things. We've earned it. Mm-hmm. None of this was given to us. God put us in a position. And you know what? Every day, all I want to do is take advantage of the blessings God's given us. I go to work every day trying to earn this. Earn the blessings that God's given us. And that is something that I think is, you talk about being Jewish. I think that's in us.
I love that. I love the humility and the recognition and the gratitude in that. I think that's something everybody can learn from.
And I understand this. If I don't win, I'm not going to keep my job. If I don't win, they're not going to put up with me being on these podcasts or talking about Israel or talking about anti-Semitism. They're like, look, shut up and coach. Shut up and recruit. And trust me, if you look at my social media and you go to Coach Bruce Pearl and you follow me on X, half of the comments after I post something about Israel or anti-Semitism or not letting Iran get a nuclear weapon or allowing Israel to finish the job and destroy Hamas, half of it is negative and attacks on me or just shut up and you're not an expert on this. And I don't proclaim to be an expert on this. But here's the deal. One of the reasons why I do it, it's really simple. What is your Middle Eastern studies course teaching you in high school? Oh, you don't have one? Oh, so then let's go on social media and let's read the lies and the propaganda. In the back of their minds, they think, well, maybe they are right. Maybe the Jews did steal the land. Maybe they did run them out of their home. Maybe, I don't know, mate. Well, that's because you've never been taught. And so you're listening to the loudest voices, who's a very, very loud minority. Let's talk about genocide for a second. Can we talk about genocide?
Yeah.
If I thought there was a genocide going on, so I'd be against it. But you know what? There's a genocide going on in Sudan right now. There's a genocide going on in China. There's a genocide going on in many, many parts of Africa. But since the Jews aren't the one killing them, nobody's talking about it.
Right.
Do you want to talk about apartheid? 50% of the medical industry in Israel, doctors, nurses, caregivers, are not Jewish. In Israel, you've got government leaders, you've got judges, you've got people in every industry and every walk of life. The Arabs that are living in Israel that don't own oil fields or aren't in government are living the best lives of any Arab population anywhere else in the Middle East. And that doesn't get talked about. It just doesn't. Yeah. So forget about apartheid and forget about genocide. And let's do one more thing. Let's stop talking about a Palestinian state. Let's stop talking about two states. There aren't two states. There are 22 states, 22 Arab states. There's only one Jewish state. And yes, back in 1948, when the powers that be decided, all right, fine, England is out of here, France is out of here. You guys are crazy. We're just going to go ahead and divide this thing up. You know, Jews, you get the swamp land. Arabs, you get the mountainous land. And we're just going to carve this thing up. The Jews said, that's awful. But you know what? We'll take it, you know?
Yeah.
And the Arabs said, you know what? We want it all from the river to the sea. And since before the state of Israel was born, there was a segment of that population that simply would not live next to a Jew, period. And so they try to kick us out of the land. They try to scare us out of the land. And they've tried to kill us out of the land. And they still are to this day. So stop with the two-state solution. We tried that in 2005. Israel pulled 10,000 Jewish people who were living in wonderful homes in the northern part of the Gaza, had jobs, had incredible greenhouses, and it was amazing for lemons and for tulips and roses and a great agricultural area. They ripped them out of their homes. They took their synagogues and their Torahs. They even had to dig up the graves of their dead, and they took them back and gave it all back to Gaza in the hopes of what? Land for peace. That maybe, just maybe, if we can give them their own place and leave, maybe they'll just be living next door to us in peace. Well, guess what? Within 2 years, they turned it into a terrorist state, and it's been that way ever since. And so there cannot be another state. Where do they want that state to be? They want that state to be in Judea and Samaria. I will not say West Bank. Only now in describing that, it is Judea and Samaria. That's how it's referred to in the Bible. That's how I will always refer to it. 80% of the Bible comes from and was written and the stories about places that were in Judea and Samaria. Hebron, Shechem, Shiloh, all these different, that's right there. The Cave of the Patriarchs, where Abraham is buried. And so listen, if there was a Palestinian state, where would the capital be? Where do they want the capital? They want it to be in East Jerusalem. Well, in East Jerusalem, there's the Garden of Gethsemane. There's Mount Moriah. There's the Temple Mount, which, oh, by the way, the Temple Mount, that's Mount Moriah where Abraham took Isaac up to be sacrificed. Do you know how many Jews would be able to be there if that was the capital? Zero.
Yeah.
None. Because we would be killed in a Palestinian state or a Palestinian capital. It makes no sense. And yet the day after October 7th, you've got kids in college campuses or people in this country supporting Hamas. It's because they're either been completely and totally misinformed, which I think is partly the case.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Or they're anti-Semitic. So now the answer. Are we going to teach it in high schools? Are the universities going to start teaching Middle Eastern studies and teaching the truth about biblically, historically, and accurately right now what's going on? And the answer is no. They're not going to do it. They want to stay institutionally neutral.
I'm curious, if in your mind the prescription is not a two-state solution, do you have a prescription of what should be, what the future should look like? Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
I have been to Judea and Samaria 7 or 8 times. I have met with Palestinian leaders and talked to them about their history and their angst. Here's what kind of needs to happen. I don't know whether you do it one community at a time, whether you take Jericho or you take Ariel or you take Hebron, and you just find a way to make that area, make Hebron great again. That's my line. Make Hebron great again. And find a way to make those communities in Judea and Samaria better for everybody. If you don't want to stay there and live in a Jewish state, you don't have to. The 2 million Israeli Arabs that are living there, they don't have to live in Israel. It's a free country. They could leave if they want to. They don't want to leave. Life is better for them there. And so I say to the people there, you are welcome to stay in your homes for as long as you want. But this whole murdering Jews and this whole, you know, getting it all back and the Nakba, that's gone. That's out. That ship sailed. That's not happening. We just got to enforce the laws and re-educate. And over a period of time, through peace, through prosperity, one community at a time, because Hamas isn't working. And Hamas, right now, if Hamas had an election right now in the communities of Ramallah or Bethlehem or some of those communities in Judea and Samaria, Hamas would win.
Yeah.
Right now. That's what the Jews are living next to. Is that hard to hear? I'm sorry it's hard to hear. It's just the truth. It's just the truth.
Is that a truth that you've seen up close and personal via your visits to the region and conversations you've had?
Yes, 100%. Mm. 100%. And again, speaking to different Palestinian leaders, they know how corrupt the Palestinian Authority is, and they don't trust them, and they shouldn't trust them. They know how vicious Islamic Jihad is. Mm. Just like Golda Meir said, when the Arabs finally recognize or believe that they love their children more than they hate the Jews, there's an opportunity there. That's what's happened in United Arab Emirates. Hasidic rabbis can get off a plane in UAE and they can walk around in the United Arab Emirates with no fear of being assaulted. Yep. You can't do that right now in Brooklyn. That's happening in Saudi Arabia. And I hope that there can be the next country in the Abraham Accords. Yep. Qatar has got to knock it off. Qatar's got to decide what they want to do. They're playing both ends against the middle, all right? And if President Trump wants to bring them into the world of what is normal, they got some choices to make. They can't keep funding the terrorism, okay, and funding the atrocities. Qatar is responsible for Iran about October 7th. They're as responsible. They funded it.
Coach, May 21st, I thought this was fascinating when I saw this. On May 21st, you speak at a breakfast for Jewish American Heritage Month in Washington, D.C., about waking up to the threat against Jews, as you say. And you say, quote, "We've got to protect ourselves from those people that want to kill us." That very night in Washington, D.C., Yaron Leshinsky and Sarah Milgram are gunned down outside the Jewish Museum in the same city by someone yelling "Free Palestine." What was your reaction when you heard this hours after saying what you said? And what do you want to say also to people watching this who are taking in this tragedy and just sort of looking for some message out of here?
I wish it was somebody that was my age, even myself. These are young kids. I've had the joy of a beautiful marriage and a beautiful wife. I've had the joy of four incredible kids. I've had joy of amazing grandchildren. I want to be around longer to see them and love them and enjoy my older years. But these kids were just getting started.
Yeah.
And they were beautiful and they were brilliant and they were kind. And they got mowed down because of the indoctrination of the lies and because of, quite frankly, the media.
Mm-hmm.
If NBC is going to air stories that, did you know that if we don't get humanitarian aid into Gaza right away, 14,000 babies are going to die? Well, I don't want 14,000 babies to die. Jonah, do you?
Of course not.
No, what can we do about it? That's a shunda. It's not true. You see? It's just not true. But people don't know that. And I don't know what this guy's ideology was. I don't know. Was he? He thinks he just freed Palestine because he mowed down two innocents. Believe it or not, I'm hopeful.
That was a nice pivot in the wind sprint there.
I swear. I'm hopeful because the Jewish people, we're not going to hate. Believe it or not, I don't hate them. I don't. They've been misinformed.
Yeah.
They've been led poorly. Israel is sick and tired of waiting on the next attack.
Yeah.
We're sick of it. We're over it. And we're not apologizing for it. And I don't care what the rest of the world thinks. How about France? How about Canada? And how about the United Kingdom? What a bunch of pussies.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? You're going to tell Israel to stand down. Oh, did anybody tell the United States of America or George Patton to stand down or the Russian armies to stand down when we were in there saving your ass to get Hitler? How many thousands of American boys died over on another continent trying to save you? And the only reason why Nazi Germany was defeated is because the United States got into the war. Mm-hmm. And we defeated Hitler. And Hamas must be defeated, because guess what? It's the only thing that certain elements of the world understand. The world is going to hate us in some ways, whether we do it or not.
Yeah.
So we might as well just go ahead and do it, because it's, God bless, the right thing to do. They're trying to prosecute a war and save as many innocents as they possibly can. But these cowards hide in hospitals. They hide underneath their civilian population. Israel's going to finish this war.
Usually I like to end my show with something like a lightning round or like a little game. So I've
not
got
good
one.
At it. I'm really bad at that lightning round.
No, I got
shit.
A different one for you. I'm going to call this one Pearls of Wisdom.
All right.
It's halftime. Your team is down by 20. What do you tell them to motivate them?
I said, you know what? We're actually in pretty good shape right now. You know why? We should be down 30. We're lucky to be down 20. Let's win these first 4 minutes, okay? Let's win these first 4 minutes. At that first TV timeout, let's see if we can cut this deficit. Let's shave 8 points off it. Let's get two or three stops. Let's go down and let's compartmentalize. Hey, man, we're in great shape. We didn't rebound. You know, we didn't check out. We couldn't make a shot. Hey, man, we're lucky we're only down 20.
Nice. Okay, it's the fourth quarter. Your team is up 2 points, and there's 30 seconds left. What do you tell them?
With 30 seconds left to go in the game, they're probably in a bonus. And so we want to play aggressively without fouling. We want to make sure we don't give them a second shot, because oftentimes late in the game, it's that second shot that matters. And let's figure out what the best defense to call. And then let's get out and let's go. Like, let's just not let them get it and foul us. Let's get the rebound. Let's get out and go. Let's get down the floor. See if we can get an easy one and end this game.
Oof. I want to, like, get up and go run onto the court right now. All right. One of your players is spotted at an anti-Israel encampment. What do you say that the next time you're able to have a conversation with that player?
I probably would bring him in and find out if he knew where he was, if he realized that he was in that sort of a situation. And I would ask him if he had any questions or what his thoughts were. I'd like to know what his thinking is. I actually am pretty excited. I'm actually coaching Abdul Bashir this year. Abdul is coming to me from Omaha, Nebraska, and we have clearly of different faiths. And I am going to, one of the things I'm done is we don't have a very large Muslim population here, but we obviously pray differently. I'm really looking forward to understanding how he prays. I'm going to try to provide as comfortable and as nice an environment for him to grow in his faith. I'd like to learn more about it. And I think he also knows he's playing for a Jewish basketball coach who's mm-hmm. very vocal on my social media platform calling out Islamic extremism. He's going to be my Ishmael and my son, maybe my Isaac, and I'm going to be his Abraham.
Nice.
And Abraham loved them both.
What is the biggest internal issue the Jewish community needs to work on in itself?
What bothers me is we're not educating our children. That's what bothers me, that we're not putting up enough fight at these colleges and universities. They're taking all this money from Qatar and all this money from some of these other countries, and they've flooded our educational system.
Yep.
Education, honestly, education and how we live our lives. Those are the most important things. And how we live our lives, if we don't practice our faith, it's pretty difficult to live our life as Jews.
Coach, thank you so much for taking the time and for being so open and raw and honest with us. We really appreciate it. Getting to get inside the mind of the master, and wish you all the best with everything. Amazing summer, good recruitment, good roster build, and an awesome next season.
Jonah, thank you, and thank you for the work that you do. And listen, just because I got these words and I'm passionate about it, don't make me right. I understand that. So I apologize. Forgive me. Offer me grace for the things that I got wrong and the mistakes that I made, or if I've upset your listeners in any way. It's clearly not my intention. And again, I am really hopeful. Israel is safer now than they were prior to October 7th. I think the mm-hmm. curtain has been pulled back. You and I may have known some of the things that we've saw on October 7th. I knew these things were possible. I don't think most of American Jewry and many people in the world knew, or unfortunately, some of them cared.
Right.
Stop caring about what other people think. Okay. Let's do the right thing. Let's do what we need to do to survive. I'm Yisrael Chai, and God bless America.
Amen. huge thank you to the coach with Kavanaugh, Bruce Pearl, not just for coming on the show today, but for his loud, proud, and public leadership. Lord knows we need it. Please, please, please subscribe to the podcast. It's so easy and it really helps me be able to keep the show going. Go to Apple Podcasts app or Spotify, search for Being Jewish with Jonah Platt, and click follow or subscribe. And then do the same thing at youtube.com/@beingjewishpodcast. I need ya. That's it for me. I'll see y'all back here for the next slam dunk episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Livyashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative, consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. And I freaking love you guys.